Coming up on the Assassins Podcast, Anne Miracco, founding partner at Floodgate, joins the show to talk about founding a venture capital firm in the midst of a financial crisis. We talk about how founders should be thinking about their business and how to communicate their business value to VCs at the pre-seed, seed, and Series A stages of company building and how those differ across stages. And then we get a little real here and we talk about why VCs say no and why Floodgate said no to Disco, not once, but twice. And then we go a little further on that to talk about what VCs actually mean when they say they're investing in the founder, not the idea. What's the message behind that? And then last part of the show focuses on the company that Anne wishes a founder would start. If you are a founder looking to raise capital at any point, this is the episode for you. Anne is a phenomenal investor. All right, without further ado, Assassins, let's get into the show. Giddy up. See them dollar signs, hustle, grind. Assassin's state of mind, hustle, grind. See them dollar signs, assassin's state of mind, assassin's state of mind, hustle, grind. See them dollar signs way above the bottom line, assassin's state of mind, hustle, grind. See them dollar signs, assassin's state of mind, assassin's state of mind, hustle, grind. See them dollar signs way above the bottom line, assassin's state of mind. They say money over everything, everything, cash in the game, shopping for a wedding ring, salary startup. What is going on, everybody? Happy Friday. It's your host, Justin Vandehey, here at the Assassins Podcast, where every week we have incredible founders and operators on the show talking about their journeys, taking their ventures from zero to one. This week on the podcast, we've got a special guest on. She is currently the co-founding partner at Floodgate. This is going to be a humbling episode, I think. I was very excited to have her on to talk about early stage venture. We pitched her not once, but I think twice when we were out there scrapping for capital in the early days. But just excited to have her in and have a conversation about all things going from zero to one. But Anne Miracco, welcome into the Assassins Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm really excited for this.
I thought we always kick things off with the founder story, but would love maybe if you wanted to open it up with a little bit about your background and would also love to talk about, yeah, the founding story behind Floodgate.
So let's see. Floodgate was founded in 2008. And so it was really at sort of the downturn in the economy. And I remember explaining to my mom that I'm starting this venture capital firm. And she's like, I thought that, you know, financial services are in distress. And this sounds like a financial service. I'm like, it's totally different. This is the time to start something.
Yeah.
How did I come to it? It's kind of interesting. My path is a little bit windy. I worked for 5 years after college. And then went back for a PhD, which is a little bit unusual. Most of my classmates had come straight through undergrad. But I had had enough work experience to know what I wanted out of my PhD. And part of what I was thinking of doing was starting a company based on the expertise that I had. And so my research was focused on modeling out risk based on cybersecurity threats and providing corporations with a better view of their financial as well as IT risks faced if you couldn't handle all of the threats that were sort of coming at you. And when I first started my research, it wasn't really a problem, but by the time I finished, it really was. But while I was in that process of working on my PhD in 2006, AWS launched. And I remember just thinking to myself, what a tremendous tool this would be for so many different use cases. But even within our research group, the idea that you can use this kind of flexible compute and storage was just kind of a very novel idea. And so because I had this experience previously, I started to think through like how that would impact startups. And in particular, one of the ways in which I extended funding for my research was that I was teaching a lot. And I was teaching entrepreneurship classes in the School of Engineering. And so I knew that all these kids were starting up companies, but their need for actual financing had really started to shift. So it used to be sell 50% of your company for $5 million. And all of a sudden we are facing, people didn't need that much money. They didn't face technical risk. They were facing market risk. And so it went from, hey, you know, I need $5 million to I need $500,000. And so we decided to launch with that kind of financial product to serve that exact need. There were really only maybe four venture firms out there that had this focus. And so you'd like open up your doors and you just have a steady stream of entrepreneurs coming through your doors that were high quality, interesting, working on new things. And it was a really exciting period. And so that's how we got started with Floodgate.
So I alluded to this in the intro. We pitched you Disco not once, but twice, and bombed horribly. And
as bombed horribly.
As a reminder, we were a Slack-based recognition tool. And so doing sort of a retro looking back on it, I wanted to unpack why you passed on Disco and what are some of the things and areas where founders' pitches sort of fall flat, if you had to sort of give more general feedback, but also Monday morning quarterback on Disco a little bit.
Yeah, and I'll give you sort of general thoughts here because I think a lot of the things that apply to Disco apply generally. So we have a pretty strong philosophy for what we look for at Floodgate. And it's partially because I think that there's only certain kinds of companies that are a great fit for seed stage investors. And then at the series A or B, you can actually be looking at numbers and traction. But at the seed stage, you have to believe that this is the moment in which to invest. And so usually what we're looking for is broadly generalized as an insight. And by insight, we mean actually something very specific. So the recipe is this. So first and foremost, in the world someplace, there's an inflection point happening. And the inflection is usually external to the startup. It could be technical. So some new technology has been invented. Maybe it's regulatory. The law has suddenly changed, creating new opportunities. Sometimes it's just, you know, the fact that you've revisited first principles and you know that some of the core assumptions that the entire industry has are just wrong. And so you can completely remake a company based on these new set of assumptions. So there's something that's happened externally that drives this business. The second piece is that you take that thing that's happened. Oh, there's also societal, like so society suddenly decides something is true. And like that can actually be this massive turning point. An entrepreneur then takes that and creates two types of insights. One is a startup insight, which is how do you manifest this in a company? So some of it is I manifest it in my product. I have something that is better, faster, cheaper. I manifested in my business model by getting rid of the middleman and creating a marketplace that directly connects the buyers to the sellers. I manifested in a distribution path because this distribution path wasn't available before, or I manifested by becoming a new type of player in the ecosystem. So there's different ways in which you can do that. And that's a startup insight. The other piece is a growth insight, which is, and so therefore, when I manifest it this way, there will be massive pull for my product because people are searching for a cheaper product and they just don't have access to it. Or I can use that extra margins to put into customer acquisition and compete unfairly in a totally new way. So there's like different ways in which you could say, this is the reason that if I manifest this inflection point in this startup, I face an exponential growth in the next, let's say, 1 to 2 years. And then on top of that, you have to say, and my secret is this part. This is the part that is non-consensus, but right. It's underappreciated. If you don't have that recipe, my belief is you're better off investing from an investor's perspective at the Series A or the Series B. because it usually means there's probably some competitors, or competitors will enter in pretty quickly. And so I have some founders who say, hey, I thought you were an early stage investor and you're telling me it's too early. Well, usually what that means is that this recipe hasn't been fulfilled. And so there's no advantage to me investing right now, because what I invest in is that secret. So that's for the seed. For the pre-seed, what the founder has to come in and say is like, you know what, this may not even work, right? So if you hate this initial version of the product, it's totally fine, because we totally admit we have not figured this out. This is not like we're headed in this direction, but then it manifests in a very different financing product, right? In that case, I say, raise less than $1 million and your valuation should really be somewhere between $5 and $7.5 million. Because otherwise, you look like a seed stage investment. And now the clock is ticking and you got to head in that direction and you got to get to traction before the Series A. And so when we're looking at pre-seed, we're looking for flexibility. We're looking for how well do you think through situations? How much conviction do you have? How loosely held is it? How fast do you build? Or are you sort of petrified of building and you just get stuck in a loophole of like just trying to gather more information? So we're assessing something very different, the pre-seed. But the seed stage, which Disco is in, there's sort of a direction you're headed in and we're looking at it from that perspective. And I think there's sort of the feeling of the why now and the growth insight didn't feel as solid. And there was sort of, and the growth insight is not just the initial growth, but we're mapping it towards like, how do you get to $100 million in revenues? That's how I view it. And it's sort of that ultimate $100 million market that happens in like 5 years, relatively profitably, is one that's a really hard one to imagine for most companies that we look at. And so that's the main challenge that we faced.
Our initial insight was we felt messaging was going to be this new operating system for enterprise, and that bots were like going to be the thing. Mm-hmm. And you saw this initial wave of just craziness around Slack ecosystem, and we raised money way too early. We had no idea what we were building. So we were, I think, part of that of, oh, we'll raise the money and figure it out. That was essentially what happened. And then the reality hit, and it was like, you know, our investors were like, oh, don't worry about it. Just grow users, grow. And then we went out to raise our Series A. And we were like, well, where's the revenue? And we were like, what the hell do you mean where is the revenue? We were just supposed to grow users. And it was like, we didn't think that we needed to do that part of it. And then obviously things cooled down. And we were sort of in this trough of death and despair for 3 or 4 years where it was like, oh my God, we have to figure out how to build a real company and business. And it was sort of this double-edged sword where we need to figure out the scale piece of it. And I just sold. I was just selling. I got us to $1 million in ARR. And then COVID hit. And it was the second wind. And it was like, oh my God, remote work. The why now piece of it became relevant again. And then we went out. I mean, that at that point, we had been at it for like 7 years. We had a term sheet for an A, but it was in the back of my mind, I was kind of looking at it and I didn't know the market was going to fall apart on the other side, but remote work was sort of that second win. So I think to your point, there was an initial insight, but we hadn't flipped over enough cards, I don't feel like, to deserve a seed investment. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think there's like another piece to that there where like also when we talk about product market fit versus a lot of what we hear from founders is that most people think of product market fit in the sort of the way YC pitches it, which is like, make something people love. And like, if you give me a dollar and I pay you 50 cents for that dollar, that's a product I'll love all day long. Or if you give me something for free, like even better, that's actually valuable to me, like fantastic. I'll love that forever. And so I really believe that product market fit has to fit within this context of a business model. And like, what? How do you extract value? It's not just about making stuff that people love. And we've returned to this notion now. It's interesting. Everyone talks about, oh, like this was a zero interest world. But the way companies have always gotten valued is cash flow. And if it's not cash flow today, it's cash flow in the future. And so even when a company is losing money today, the reason why investors invest, or they're supposed to invest, is because they believe that the company will eventually spit out cash, profitability, EBITDA, all these other things, right? And so I think we, from a venture perspective, sometimes forget that that's the ultimate goal of a business, that you're selling something at higher than what it, at a price that's higher than what it costs you to build it. And then hopefully your customers actually value it even more than what you're even pricing it at. That's sort of economics 101. And that is part of product market fit. Because if you throw that out, then of course people will love your product. And yeah. So that's why we think through this, like, hey, how can you get to $100 million on this business? And how challenging is that to believe? And some businesses get to $1 million and then they peter out. Some of them get to 10. And we've seen those companies even flatten out. There are even other companies at 50. That's like tremendous scale, but they can't just get over that hump. And so there's these different places where companies will flatten out, and $100 million is extraordinarily rare. And so we try to picture that in our minds.
Man, there's so much in there. We were almost like a wedge in a wedge. We picked a Slack wedge, and then we were recognition in the wedge of the HR tech stack when there was all this consolidation happening with back of office. Yeah.
It was a good wedge, right? Like, I think employee recognition was a space where it was new and you wanted to see someone come into that space. But then the other thing that you have to believe is that that wedge captures either data or creates a network, then that can fast expand to a whole stack. And either the founder has to explicitly talk about why that wedge gets you there, or they have to say that that wedge alone is going to become a huge business.
There's so many good stories around. I think in general, just learning from experts and VCs as you go through this process, because Mamoon Hamid basically rewrote our entire pitch deck when we met with Mamoon at Social Capital at the time.
Yeah.
And then Josh Felser asked the same question at Freestyle when we met with him. And he's like, what do you want to be? What are you trying to be, basically? Do you want to be worked? You need to do a better job of communicating that and laying that out. And then we figured it out. And then it was like, okay, shit. Now when we raise our Series A, we joked about this. We felt like there needed to be almost like a physical challenge aspect of raising capital, because we Jeremy went out and at Emergence Capital and they did this tennis event. And I'm like, dude, there's no fucking way we're going to raise a Series A if you're going out there to showcase your tennis. But I think there were a lot of the same concerns in meeting with Jason Green, where after we got through that first tranche, how many billion-dollar companies have been built on the backbone of somebody else's platform? And we kind of looked at each other, I guess, what was Exact Target? You could talk about, you know, sales support. But I think that general consensus was that was an eye opener for us when we sort of assessed our options at the end of the Disco journey to say, man, we're going to have to raise a lot more money to compete with CultureAmp and Rippling and Deal and all these other HR giants. Okay. So you've made some killer investments over time, like Lyft, TaskRabbit, if you've ever heard of those companies. You have a really solid intuition for, you alluded to this in the early stages of when you can get a unique insight, but what do you think is the secret sauce or signal that lets you know that this opportunity could be big?
I think it's sort of that, what I just said. It's if a company is already headed in a direction, it's a core seed investment, you're raising, let's say $2 to $3 million. I have to believe that that direction has potential. And the way we look at it is through these inflection points and the insights that you have. What's the secret that you know? How non-consensus is it? And then for founders, I think what I'm looking for is twofold. So we've noticed actually a lot of our portfolio companies go through pivots. And so we think a lot about founders and what are we investing into? Because if you're not, you know, most of the time I'm not investing into the idea because I know the idea is going to change. When we say we're investing into founders, we actually mean that in a very specific way, because we have experienced the idea changing, and hopefully even as the idea changes, we still believe in that founder. And so what does that mean? Well, we are looking for two types of people within the founding team. One is a super builder, which I think most people would understand. It's someone who really just loves to build things. But even more than that, it's like someone who not only builds things, but unemotionally throws away the code base. So this isn't working. That's fine. What are we building next? Sometimes I see people get very hung up on, well, I spent so much time building this thing, and so they can't let go. And then the other piece that I see is it's a combined capability with another person who is a super thinker. And a super thinker is someone who is just a voracious learner and a person who cares deeply about the idea maze. So they will not only know everything to know about this business today, and they're so curious, they've asked all the questions, they understand the risks, the ways in which things can go right, but also the ways in which things can go wrong. They know 10 steps ahead what is possible. But even more than that, they've looked outside of themselves and they know the history of the space. They know what's been tried. They've talked to all of the folks who've been there and done that. They know who could potentially enter into the space, and they have a story for why those people and those companies will be less successful than they will. So they just really have an absolute voracious curiosity to learn more about this than anyone else. So if an investor, an employee, an expert asks them any question, they will have thought through this 5, 10, 15 steps much more than anyone else has. And that's a full-time job. And so we look for people who have that capacity. And if they do, it's sort of like the Mark Andreessen product market fit essay. They will actually find the best market. They may start in a really crappy market, but they will get there. And so that's what I mean by, like, we invest in people. It's not like we invest in people we like or who are super nice. Those are all great things and attributes to have. But these attributes are the must-have.
Not the forehand. The backhand or the forehand. It's not the technical challenge. Okay. So talking about early stage, what company do you wish some founder would start today that doesn't exist?
So we have some actually in the consumer space, which is, you know, we think that there is this whole slew of digital and products that have just exploded. Just the number of brands, the number of publications, everything has just exploded from a consumer standpoint. And we think that actually, while machine curation is great, we also think human curation is quite important. And what we would love to see out there is something that combines both of these. And so the example that I would give you is, like, we had this company called Oneiro in our portfolio a while ago, where you could follow someone and that person really cared about, let's say, fashion. And she would constantly be curating the Nordstrom's product feed. And if I could find someone who was 45 years old, professional, roughly in my income range, that person was a goldmine for me, because she was doing the shopping for me or the curation for me that I never have the patience to do. We think about that from travel. We think about that in any kind of space where you're wanting the expertise of another person and not just a machine. Think about it in travel. Like when you go someplace, you probably ask 5 of your friends for recommendations because they just went there. It's probably hidden in email. It's probably hidden in Google Doc. You probably post it to Facebook and say, hey, Facebook friend, where have you been in Italy that you loved? And then you incorporate all of these things into a final itinerary. Well, that's partially human curation, but you might also be looking at some machine curation too. So that's an area that we've been spending a lot of time in. And as generative AI becomes more interesting, we think the combination is really critical, but the piece that we're really looking for is a user interface that causes individuals to actually incorporate some of this data that they have from their friends and family and allow the machine to grow smarter and understand the network in which you operate. That's what we're looking for.
I was just riffing on that a little bit. I almost feel like I know this is not consumer, but I'm sure it applies to the workplace as well, as I think about your experience having worked at a place, or what is the next generation of what is culture actually like? I guess that's why I'm viewing everything these days through workplace culture, because it is a day job, but I can definitely see some really interesting applications. Okay, transition here. First, congrats on the launch of Reactor. For folks that aren't as familiar with Reactor, what is the Reactor program? And would love to also just talk a little bit about how it differs from other accelerators out there, from YC and others.
Yeah, and this is sort of still sausage being made, so I can't say this is the final form of Reactor. But so I teach a program at Stanford called Mayfield Fellows, which is now, I think, in its 27th or 28th year. We've had really illustrious alumni, including the founders of Instagram and the founder of Gusto, came through this program as undergrads. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we've gotten really good at is spotting talent even before they declare themselves as talent. We get 150 applications for this program and select 12 students. They're part of a 9-month program. Part of the issue is we're also expanding this program to really make sure we have this great community of builders, but also humanities majors. And one of the things that I was sad about is that this is a program that's only at Stanford. And so with my team, I was just saying, what if we reimagine what was possible for founders? And Mayfield Fellows isn't just for founders. It's really teaching entrepreneurship and leadership. So it's a much more expansive mandate. But you can see, like, there are some of these students who really wanted to found things. And they wanted to do it sooner and sooner. And so I was saying, okay, if we thought about it from the ground up and we found this incredible talent, what would we teach them? And part of it was, one, we would want them to have some dollars in place, because we didn't want this to become some program that only the rich kids could do. So we recognize that there are a bunch of kids out there who need the summer internship to help pay for tuition. We are seeing actually more and more students who, even with their summer tuition, the summer work that they do, they're helping out their families, right? So that payment in the summer is actually very important. So we wanted to make sure that they were getting paid. And the second piece was, I wasn't sure if after 10 weeks, students would actually have a great idea. And so instead of declaring, hey, we're going to have this demo day on this day, and you're going to create a startup no matter what, I wanted to give them an opt-out. And so I wanted to tell them, hey, you're on track to figuring out something really amazing. Or, hey, you've had this experience now, and you now know what standards we hold companies to. You can either go work at a company or work at a startup, or, you know, go and do whatever, like, your life dreams are. But now you have this experience. And what I loved about it is one of the founders who came through the program, who ultimately didn't end up starting a company, she said, this program, I think I'm going to start a company in the future. But now I really understand. I understand on a granular level what the expectations are. And I feel like this program itself was my inflection point. And that was really, like, that was incredible for us. So we bring students into our office over the summer. I think my office manager will kill us, because there's just, like, so many college students, and they are learning together, and they're building. And every Tuesday, I hold personal office hours in the spring. And from January on, we have online curriculum to help sort of prep them and get them through sort of the Idea Maze journey. And we just try to support them and create, like, this really incredible community. Out of 10 teams last year, 4 of them got funded, and that's one awesome. Of them got acquired. So we had a really great hit rate, and so we'll see what happens this year. But, like, my passion is identifying people who could be founders and help supporting them on that journey. And so that's why sort of Reactor might take different forms in the future, but that's the ultimate objective.
Okay, I know we're coming to the end of the time here. I want to ask some of the most important questions, obviously. And speaking of growth, maturity, transition, your wonderful hubby, Al, was actually my formal mentor at Intuit. historically, Dan Warnikoff was initially the guy, that CEO,
amazing guy,
who was my first mentor. And I, in my first job, told them how much I hated working at Intuit. So they were like, oh my God, this guy is just on the fast track to unemployment. So then they pawned me off to Al. And Al, tough love. I love the guy to death. When I was a young, fresh out of college, he gave me the first piece of feedback professionally in my career, where he said, you have to shave your sideburns and wear a collared shirt. Those were the first two things that Al said to me as a, and so I had, the most important question I had is, who has a better fashion sense, you or Al?
Oh, that's like, that's unfair, because I think, well, obviously I do, but
yeah,
you know, but she, it's so funny, because I think it was right around that time that I was telling one of our associates that he needed to shave his mustache. I think I remember when this was going on, because I was like, you know what? I just got back from a one-on-one, and I had to tell our associate to shave his mustache. And
what's, he was like, these young kids with the facial hair. Was it Tommy? It was probably Tommy.
Yeah. Yeah. He had this crazy, like circus man mustache. And at first I said, you know, Mike, you have to tell him. And then we were unsure that Mike had really given him direct feedback. So finally I was like, hey, Tommy, it's got to go.
It's funny, because we were both working together in the same rotation at that time. And so I felt like, and I, you know, Tommy was the adult in the room. So I was like, you know what?
Oh, no.
That's hilarious. I figured it was Tommy. All right. So as we round this out, I just wanted to close with, so what's next for Floodgate? And then is there anything else that you wanted to plug?
Well, we are always, what I would say is, for Floodgate, it's actually, we're sticking to our knitting. And we don't change. We are not a small fund trying to become a bigger fund. The thing that we're always looking for are just people who are thinking of starting startups. And we're not the best investors if you already have a term sheet. In fact, we'll probably say we're not going to get to an answer in time. And so some people decide to come to Floodgate really late. I think they think that if they do that, then we'll have pressure to move fast. We are horrible under pressure to move fast. We love to take our time making decisions. We love to get to know founders. I only make 2 to 5 investments every year. And so it's not like you're one of 100 investments and we might text message once in the next year. We are sort of holding hands and jumping off the cliff together. And so I would encourage founders to approach us sooner rather than later. And we have a lot of ways in which we engage with founders as they are ideating. And so if people are in that position, I would say get in contact with us and let us know.
Awesome. This was so fun. Super grateful for you coming on. And I know we had the chance to pitch you a couple times, but it's been cool to sort of just do a retro on Disco and talk about what you're focused on. And obviously got a lot of love for you and Al.
Well, thank you so much. And congratulations on everything.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Thanks, Anne.
All right, that is a wrap. Again, shout out to Anne Mirico, to Mike Maples, the entire team at Floodgate. And shout out to Tommy Leap and that mustache. Man, those were formative years, and apparently facial hair was in then. So I'm just glad we made it through that in one piece. And also just super grateful for Anne and her willingness to share what is most effective for founders trying to raise capital and how to position their startup in the early days. So incredible episode, and thank her for that. This week on the podcast, we have got an incredible guest on. One of the founders of WeWork is going to be joining the show to talk about early days at WeWork and what he is working on now. You're going to want to tune into that one. It's going to be a great episode. In the meantime, appreciate everyone tuning in. Keep hustling. Keep grinding. See them dollar signs. Hustle. Grind. Assassin state of mind. Hustle. Grind. See them dollar signs. Assassin state of mind. Assassin state of mind. Hustle. Grind. See them dollar signs way above the bottom line. Assassin state of mind. Hustle. Grind. See them dollar signs. Assassin state of mind. Assassin state of mind. Hustle. Grind. See them dollar signs way above the bottom line. Assassin state of mind. They say money over everything. Everything engaged in the game. Shopping for a wedding ring. Salary, startups, crypto, stock exchange. Appreciate every penny.
I can change. One phone call and your life can change. What's your love language? Can't do business if it ain't reciprocated. Closing deals on a daily, weekly, monthly. Real, recognize real, your dudes is active.